Hi there, you're listening to the Food Talk Show. This is the Food Talk Show with Sue Nelson and the gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous Christy Ellis. Hi, Christy.
Hello, Sue. How are you?
Yeah, good. I'm feeling a little bit nervous because I haven't got my pal here. I haven't got Paul Andrews here today. So we're just girlies. I've just asked two girls.
I think it's a bit better, don't you?
Well, I shouldn't really say that. But we are joined by Matt Havers of Peck Natural Goodness. And Tom Webster of Grow Up Urban Farms, and they've both got some really interesting stories to tell, slightly different things from what we normally have on the show, I think.
Yeah, I'd say so. And we've also got Bit Spicy, haven't we, coming up for the We Hate Heston?
Yes, so Paul Andrews and I, we were doing some curry tasting, which I'm sure you can imagine is one of my favourites, but it's definitely one of Paul Andrews' favourites. Oh, so we were doing some curry tasting with Andrew Anderson, and Andrew Anderson runs Bit Spicy, which are these amazing sort of just spice sachets that he makes. So we can talk about that later, but we'll have that interview. And that was really great fun. Some of it, as I'm sure you'll be well aware, far too hot for me.
Oh yeah, you're a little bit chilly.
I'm a bit of a wuss.
Whereas Paul absolutely adores a bit of spice.
He does. So I'm going to talk about Tom Webster first, who's from Grow Up Urban Farms. And if you want to check out what he's doing, it's at growup.org.uk. And Grow Up was founded in 2013 by Tom and Kate Hoffman. And their aim really was to build a sustainable commercial urban farm and growing food for local markets. So really, I guess what you're saying is that they've built a farm inside a warehouse unit, in essence. And it's a sort of small-scale agricultural production unit. And they've also got space for events and community engagement. And their aim was to feed people locally. So they started growing small quantities of herbs, salads, microgreens, you know, all that healthy stuff that you're supposed to eat, Christy.
Yeah.
We eat that. Obviously, Paul Andrews doesn't. and they're doing aquaponics and hydroponics, which I don't really understand. So I'm definitely going to ask Tom.
I don't understand at all. No. So this is going to be an education for me.
Yeah. So we're going to actually obviously talk to Tom about that. Not only that, though, he started, I was going to say grow fish, but you can't grow fish, can you? Well, he started having fish in his tanks. And it just sounds like a really interesting business. So welcome to the Food Talk Show, Tom.
Thank you very much.
And well, first of all, why did you create the business? Why did you and Kate start off doing this?
You know, I think we both, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, there wasn't a lot of talk about sustainable food. And it's something that's very close to mine and Kate's kind of heart and we're very passionate about. So we wanted to start a business where we could grow food sustainably close to where it was consumed to both reduce food waste, but also start to reconnect people with the food they're eating.
And what do you mean by reconnect exactly? I mean, do you really feel that people have lost that connection?
Not everyone, but I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand how their food's produced. And particularly in cities, food is something that happens elsewhere. And you buy it in the supermarket and that's how food works. And I think the more we can do to introduce people to different ways of growing food, the better place they are to make better choices as consumers.
I mean, I think I find when I go to London nearly every day during the week, and what I'm finding when I go to London is that nobody seems to be cooking, hardly at all. You can get amazing food and amazing choices and very good, clean food. But do you think that's making people even more disconnected because they're buying, you know, they're buying salad bags or they're buying, you know, a salad that's already made up or they're buying noodles, you know, healthy though they may be, but somebody's already made those for you. Do you think that's a worse thing or a better thing?
It's an interesting conundrum, really, because on one side it might be that they get further away from it because they engage with it physically less. But actually, if you give people are buying greater variety of food, they're making better choices about the food they're eating. Maybe they're connecting with it more.
Hmm. Yes, interesting one. So both Christy and I are dying to know. Can you just explain to me what aquaponics is? From a real basic point of view. And I don't actually understand the difference between aquaponics and hydroponics. So do you mind giving us a little quick short lesson on that?
Not at all. So quite simply, aquaponics is a combination of two fairly well-established farming practices. The first one is aquaculture or fish farming. And the second one is hydroponics. So hydroponics is where you grow plants in a nutrient-rich solution, so essentially water with nutrients in.
So you're growing plants in water as opposed to soil? Exactly.
So there's no soil. We seed our plants into a growing media, and we feed that growing media with nutrient-rich water. So in hydroponics, those nutrients would come from an inorganic nutrient source. And what we do is we take the wastewater from the fish farm, and we use that as a nutrient source for the hydroponic system.
So you've got fish in your farm. What sort of fish? I'm thinking not goldfish.
Not goldfish, no. So they're edible fish. They're a species of fish called tilapia. Now, tilapia, not incredibly well known in the UK, but
is
actually
it New Zealand, I'm thinking, was it?
It's actually the second most widely farmed fish in the world. It's native to the Nile in Africa, but also really extensively farmed throughout Asia, the Americas, actually really, really popular in the States as well. And it's really pegged as the sustainable fish of the future because it's an incredible fish. It has a really good protein conversion rate, which is it basically means that for every kilo of food you put in, you get a lot of growth out of the fish. But also it's omnivorous. So it means you can move away from fish meal-based protein sources for the
just
for
feed
the fish.
It anything, obviously. Essentially. If it eats anything, yeah. Okay, so you've got tilapia in your sort of big fish tanks, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. And then you use any of the sort of nutrients that you do get and put that back into to growing sort of herbs and you know, these sort of microgreens.
Yeah, correct. So what happens is the water passes through the fish tanks. After it's gone through the fish tanks, it goes through three levels of filtration. The first removes any sediments and dirt from the water. The next level of filtration is a biological filter that just converts the ammonia, which is quite toxic to the fish. It converts that into nitrates, so a very easy to absorb form of nitrogen for the plants. And then we run it through a UV filter, which kills any bacteria in the water, after which it's ready to be used for the plants.
Sounds incredibly technical, really. And I know you at university you studied environmental biology and environmental science. I'm sure that's coming in then pretty good use here.
You know, yeah, it is very useful. But what I will say is that actually, what we're doing, this may seem kind of counterintuitive to a lot of people, but I think it's an incredibly natural way of growing food. We're essentially taking an animal's waste. It's being broken down by naturally occurring bacteria, and then we're using those nutrients. To feed plants, so it's just replicating the nitrogen cycle.
Do you have any of these lovely green things to eat? Are we allowed to try some?
I do have some.
We're going to ask. I think we're going to ask Matt if he doesn't mind just leaning over and finding some greenery there.
Useful.
It all looks good. Yeah. And Matt's bought some eggs, so I'm hoping he's going to cook me a little omelette later, but probably not.
Okay.
So explain to us what we've got here.
So this is one of our microgreens. It's called it's coriander. It's probably our most popular microgreen.
What does a microgreen mean?
So a microgreen is essentially the first leaves of a plant. It's extremely nutrient rich, but it's also extremely strong in flavour. And it's very pretty. They used to decorate a lot of dishes in nice restaurants.
So if I describe that here, it's really nice, Christy, take that. This is really good if Paul's not here because we've got all healthy stuff. None of that.
Yeah, he wouldn't like it, would he?
No, he wouldn't like this at all. It looks exactly like coriander, except that the leaves are tiny and it's absolutely delicious, much tastier than normal coriander because, as you say, these presumably are the first leaves to come through. Is
exactly.
That right? Yeah. They're really lovely, aren't they?
Yeah, really nice. They do taste like coriander. Mm. They don't look
sort of coriander on speed, aren't they? They're really, really tasty.
So supercharged
coriander. Supercharged coriander, yeah.
I've also got some of our salad leaves with us, though, because we don't just focus on the microgreens. We grow a lot of herbs and salads. So I have pea shoot here, which is one of our more popular ones.
Oh, pea shoot,
mind if I do?
Pea shoots are my favourite.
And also some baby watercress, which is also really popular.
This is so attractive, isn't it? Just sitting here shoveling greens into your mouth.
I'm glad I'm on the radio because I'm thinking I've probably got a bit of green sticking in my teeth. Yeah. It doesn't look particularly attractive.
All the pea shoots are lovely.
Good, thank
you. I know, I really like pea shoots. If anybody's listening who hasn't had pea shoots, if you grow a peas and you pick your peas, they all taste lovely, of course. But actually, the sort of stalks and the leaves around the peas actually taste fabulous. To me, they taste better than peas, and they're more pea-like than peas in their taste. And they really are great in salad.
Yeah, like a true pea shoot should be quite, you know, it's firm, it's juicy, but you get that really sweet flavour of the pea coming through as well.
They are just... When I was little... You know, I'm used to pod peas. Sometimes mum used to get those peas.
Eating them.
I'm sure she just used to get them just to keep us occupied and stand on a chair and pod all these peas. And when you eat the raw peas, they taste great, don't they? When they're
better
tiny
than,
and sweet.
Yeah, better than
cooked.
And
that to me is what pea shoots taste of. I think they taste great.
Yeah, they are really nice. Try this one. This is peppery.
What is that? Oh,
That's a baby watercress.
Do you want to pass some of these to poor old Matt?
Pass the greens round.
And the watercress, and these are lovely. So, do you have to wash them afterwards, or do you just?
So, all of our salad is served unwashed. So, it's when we did send it to retailers or restaurants, it goes out with a label on that says unwashed salads. But in reality, the salad itself never comes into contact with anything during its life cycle because all the irrigation happens to the roots. There's no water sprayed onto the crop. We use no pesticides, so there's no chemicals sprayed onto the crop. And it's grown in a very clean environment, so actually the crop itself is very clean.
Yeah. Well, I think they're absolutely delicious, aren't they?
Really nice.
So what you're trying to do is you're creating this in the middle of a city. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get the community involved, I know. So what you're trying to do is grow local food for local people. How are you managing to get sort of local people engaged?
So we do that in several ways. The first thing we do is all of our farm operators are employed locally. So we work with a charity on identifying young people who don't necessarily have a good history of in employment. We bring them on, we train them up, we give them a full-time role with all the perks of a full-time position. And so that's one way we work with the local community. The other way is we have a second company called Grow Up Community Farms. And the focus of that is around education and engagement. And we do work with local schools. We have a demonstration system called the Grow Up Box. It was actually the first thing we built as a company. It's a shipping container with a greenhouse on top. In the greenhouse is a hydroponic system, and in the shipping container is some fish tanks. So we get people down to that. We show them how the system works. We talk to them about sustainable food production. We talk to them about... You know, aquaponics.
Do you just get them excited about what you're doing, really?
Yeah, you know, fish poo is really easy to get people excited about. It's particularly kids. It's a great way to engage kids with food. And like kids, you know, traditionally don't really like greens. And then you tell them it's grown on fish poo, and then they eat it, and it tastes. You know, the flavors are quite intense, and it really engages them in a way they wouldn't have before.
Excellent. I mean, I really like them, and I think there is for me this thing about food security going on. You know, where we're buying all this food from abroad. And then we're growing food here and sending it abroad. So I don't really understand the thing where we buy apples from abroad and then we grow our own apples and then send them abroad. It just seems crazy to me. And I do think that we have to look at food security and this issue of involving the community in you know, local food.
You know, I think food security is a really important issue. You know, particularly one of the reasons that we grow the produce we do is because it's extremely perishable. And if we're importing crops, it takes an extra day or two to get to the consumer. I mean, how often has a bag of salad gone off in your fridge? It's incredible how often it happens. And if we can start to reduce that food waste, it's a massive benefit. And also all the energy associated with transporting it, keeping it cool, absolutely. And storing it.
Absolutely. And I know you offer open days and tours, don't you?
We do.
And I would imagine, and you've got something called Grow Up Box?
Yes, so we have two things. We have the farm, which is the warehouse in Beckton, and then we have the box, which is the shipping container with the greenhouse on top in Stratford. And we run tours of the farm, and we also do open days at the box.
And again, another great way to get people involved, particularly children,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Would your girls go, Christy?
Yeah, I think they would. When you were talking about it a second ago, if I show the girls, I've got two children, something that they can eat in the garden, they're obsessed with it. We've got like little wild strawberries in the garden. And I'm just like, can you just make sure you check with me first? But they love picking stuff and eating it. So I think it's really nice that you can take, you know, school children and kids to somewhere in such an urban area that means that they get the chance to do that and actually learn a little bit about it.
And get a link.
Yeah,
that's good. That's really good, I think. I believe there are similar urban farms like this in Tokyo and Singapore and New York. Are you the only one in the UK, or have you seen others that are doing what you're doing?
So We're the only urban farm doing aquaponics in the UK. There is another one who's doing hydroponics, and they just specialise in the microgreens. But really, with the aquaponics and the vertical growing, we're one of the biggest in Europe.
If you're just listening to all that rustling going on, anybody, it's because it's Matt fiddling around with his eggs. Not quite sure.
Way to make him feel guilty, see?
Oh, no, I know. He's fiddling around with
his
eggs.
You're right.
Which is great.
Don't
it's
worry.
Great. I don't know whether he's going to cook me an omelette later or not. Probably not. Are you cooking anything? No.
I forgot the pan.
You forgot the pan. Well, I think we can find one. I'm sure I can get somebody from upstairs to find one for us. Now, I know you've created this business, Tom. What's your vision for it? I can imagine it's not making you huge sums of money. It's probably the sort of thing that is a lifestyle business where you're making a living, but you're not going to be a millionaire off this. But what's your vision for it?
This is definitely not a London-centric business. The issues around food security and access to good quality food are existing all across the UK and all across the world. And what we'd like to see is grow up urban farms in cities around the UK, Europe and the rest of the world, growing food that's suitable to the local market. I mean, one of the great things about what we can do is we can change the environment to grow different leaves in different environments to meet the market demand. So yeah, really as a part of a global solution to many of the food issues we're facing right now.
Well, I think it's a really it's a really good idea, and we're seeing a lot of people using food waste, aren't we, Christine, in some of the interviews that we're having.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think a lot of people are really trying to work out how they can grow food and deliver food in a much better way.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Do you think since you started the business, you've seen a big shift in people's attitudes? I don't know if it's just because we're meeting people at shows and things, but it really feels like the topic's kind of a bit more at the forefront now.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Certainly when I first started looking into this maybe 6-7 years ago, I worked in sustainability at the time, and everyone was talking about energy and water.
Yeah.
No one talked about food. It was something that happened elsewhere, and it just, which is incredibly, I think, naive. And increasingly, over the last 6 years, it's become more and more on the agenda. You've got, big chefs doing great things with food, making mm-hmm. it popular, making it engaging and making it accessible. And then you've got a lot more people talking about generally sustainability. It's coming more and more into the kind of commonplace dialogue, but also food is now on that agenda in a way that it never was 4 years ago.
I think younger people are a lot more aware, like teenager sort of age, yeah. than they ever have been before about their food choices and their health as well.
Yeah, I think the information's a lot more readily available. I think it's excellent.
Mm. Well, very interesting indeed. And if anybody's wants to learn more about Grow Up Urban Farms, they need to go on growup.org.uk. Really, really interesting thing. Now, what I'm going to ask you, Tom, before we go on to our next sort of segment is favourite curry? Do you like curries?
Ooh, yeah, I'm a big fan of a lambuna.
A lambuna. What was that one? What's in that?
It's kind of tomatoey, but quite spicy, nice thick sauce and lamb.
And do you cook your curries at home yourself?
I dabble. I dabble in curry. Mm. Yeah.
And Matt, are you a curry fan?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's many people who would say they aren't. But
my mum's not. I just thought I'd tell you that.
Oh, no. Yeah. Maybe it's a generational thing then. Yeah. Yeah, no, I fluctuate wildly, though. Sometimes I'll just fancy, the driest curry that's going, and then sometimes I'll be like, I just want it swimming.
Yeah, for me, it's a Friday night thing. At the end of the week, and you just think, I need some spice. I don't know, you like chilli, don't you, Christine?
Yeah,
I do.
I love a curry as well.
Yeah, and when you go to France or somewhere and they have all this lovely food, but they don't really have much spice, I am desperate when I get home.
Yeah, I know what you mean. We're in Spain, and my husband couldn't handle the lack of spice in the food.
Yeah, quick, find some chilies somewhere. So Paul and I went to see Andrew Anderson, and Andrew grew up in Southeast Asia, and he's a real expert on curries. And when he came back over to the UK, he was so disappointed in what he was tasting. He just didn't feel it was particularly authentic. And he set up Bit Spicy, which is basically got great packaging. Actually, basically he mixes all the spices for you. So he grinds all the spices, mixes them for you. There's loads and loads and loads of different spices you can choose from, and basically you just get these powders, They're much fresher than ones you can buy, but they're also mixed for you. So you've got a really good balance of the spices. And then, of course, you add, you know, your meat or veg or whatever it is. Coconut milk and stuff like
nice.
That. Anyway, Paul and I are really lucky because what Andrew did is he'd made, I think it was 6 curries for us.
But Paul was in heaven.
Yeah, Paul was in heaven. And obviously we started from the, you know, from the sort of not quite so hot to the screaming hot. and so what I'd like to do is I'd just like to pay you this interview that we had with Andrew Anderson. Spoon in his hand, he's clapping his hands, he's very, very excited.
I'm really excited.
I am so excited because we're with BitSpicy and it's bitspicy.com. We're with Andrew Anderson, who's a director, he owns the company. I know BitSpicy quite well because I use their products quite a lot. And essentially, you've so got to get into this, Paul. Essentially, they do the most beautiful bags of spices that have all been mixed for you. You've still got to do a little bit of cooking and the balance of the stuff is really, really good. I use them a lot. And Andrew has very thoughtfully prepared some curries for you. So can you believe you have 6 curries to taste?
I know. I've died and I've gone to heaven.
And I have to say, because I have these at home, some of them are quite hot.
Oh, good.
Yes. Before we start, though, Andrew, when did you start the company? Is it fairly new? It's been around for a little while.
Well, we started the company about 3 years ago. I grew up in the Far East. I went to the Anglo-Chinese school in Singapore. I was the Anglo, along with my younger brother, and everyone else was Chinese. And when we came back, we were very disappointed in the quality of the food, especially as far as curries are concerned. Most of our curries are Southeast Asian, Indonesian, and also we do some Burmese curries, mostly Northern Thai ones. Thai curries in particular we don't actually offer because they're mostly fresh. But if you go to our website, we've got the recipes for the green, the yellow and the red curry paste, which you can print off for free.
Yes, and I've tried all of those, so I can attest to how good they are. Now, you've got 6 curries, and you were saying, Andrew, we have to taste them in a particular order. Why is that?
Yeah, because, well, the simple fact of the matter is because it plays with your taste buds. You've got the coconut-based ones, and then you've got the tomato-based ones. So this is the mildest one we do. It's the Madras, the Bangladesh. That's a mild one. Very roughly ground spices. So you'll see that that's got a mild flavour to it. Very good with chicken, lamb or beef.
And what's in that? What sort of spices?
Well, actually, believe it or not, it's just got your standard 6 spices, things like cumin and coriander. But what loads of people don't realise is that if you, depending on how roughly you grind spices, it gives a completely different flavour. So these ones are actually very roughly ground.
And your taste verdict on that one?
It's delicious. It's absolutely delicious.
A bit mild for you.
It is a mild curry. That doesn't mean I wouldn't eat it, because I certainly would.
It's tasty.
Mm.
It is a mild curry. It's supposed to be a mild one.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, it's quite dark coloured.
It is. It's a gorgeous colour.
You say that's mild. That's just starting to get to the top of what
it's
I can cope with.
It's got a little bit of a burn to it, but it's supposed to be mild. There's actually no chilli in that at all.
That's breakfast curry.
Okay. Yeah, breakfast okay. Curry. And then the second one?
Okay, the next one, again, tomato-based, okay? This is we call it the North Indian meatball curry mixture, but basically it's a classic North Indian curry mixture. You can have it, you don't have to make meatballs out of it, you can have it with chicken. It's actually a fantastic vegetarian version as well.
Paul, can you not eat it all, please, because I'd like to taste some, thank you. And meatballs is what you would recommend?
Well, you can make it out of lamb koftas, yeah. You don't have to, though. You can just have it with bunches of, you know, chicken or whatever.
That's got lovely coriander with it, I think. That is not mild, though.
It's not mild. It's not overly hot.
It's not mild for you, though.
No, absolutely. it's got a gorgeous flavour, a gorgeous taste. And as you say, you can taste the coriander in it.
And some nice, like, a bit of sourness there, I think, as well. I quite like the sourness to it.
Yeah.
Okay, cardamom, well, I'm guessing.
Moving over to the coconut based ones. Okay, this one is a Cochin curry. It's just a classic general South Indian curry mixture. Very good with beans as a vegetarian option, lamb or chicken. Doesn't really work with red meat, that one.
Coconut background on that?
Absolutely. I'll tell you what it reminded me of, and Andrew kind of hit the nail on the head before he said it doesn't work with red meat. It's almost it's almost like a dal, yeah.
So this is the next one. This is a rendang. It's a Malaysian rendang, comes from Negeri Sembilan. It's completely different from an Indonesian rendang, because Indonesian rendangs tend to be darker and a lot thicker. This one's a little lighter, and it's got that one benefits from a very slow cook. So something like venison or beef. You can do it with chicken, but cook the sauce first if you're doing chicken. But it needs
so the sauce needs a bit of a long sort of cook. And as we know, if you're going to cook beef curry, you need to cook beef for a couple of hours, like you would a stew, and make sure it's really infusing and really lovely.
I would use that. It's almost like a gravy, if you see what
that's
I mean.
That's correct. Yeah, that's exactly as they would do it in Malaysia and Singapore. They don't actually regard that as a curry as such as we would regard. It's just a stew, and that's the gravy for the stew. That's absolutely exactly it. Yeah.
I like that. That's my favourite so far, because of all the curries I've had, that's really quite different.
Right.
Mm, and it is juicy, sort of graviness. Yeah.
Mm. It's a lovely taste. I'm going to reserve judgment until I've tried the other two.
Okay.
Right, okay, well, this one actually might grate on the... Because this is basically the Indonesian version of... It's a Sulawesi, but it's an Indonesian version of a Musliman curry. So this one's particularly good, you've got to bear this in mind, particularly good with beef. You can do it with chicken, and also very good as a vegetarian option. Particularly good with beef, green beans, and potatoes.
I was going to say, potatoes for me is a Musliman curry type of
exactly
classic accompaniment,
Well, funnily enough, I'm used to Musliman... curries with lamb.
All right.
Yeah.
Really?
No. Yeah. Do that with that as well. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And that is gorgeous. That is absolutely gorgeous.
Aren't these tasty? Don't you think? Mm. And also, everyone for me is absolutely different flavour profile.
They are all.
Whereas often. Yeah. Everything's the same. Whereas all of those are very, very, very different.
And funnily enough, having tasted five now, you'd think, you know, my palate would start to fall apart, but I can taste the difference.
About to now.
Yeah.
You wait.
We've saved the best of
this is well. We do three at this level. We do the Malay one. We do a Goan red, which is tomato based, and then we do another coconut based one, which is an Indonesian padang. But they're at the same heat level, so try that one. And if you don't think that one's hot enough, our three chili foil mixture is six times hotter than that.
Six times. Oh my goodness! Right, I'm going to watch Paul. I'm not even sure I'm going to eat this one. I'm going to watch Paul eat it. He's just put it in his mouth.
You have to wait for it, because it'll come and get you. We grow these chilies ourselves, and they get you at the back of the throat, and it's a slow burn.
Whoa.
You just got
it. You're absolutely right, Andrew. I was going to go, nah, there's nothing in that, but there is.
Exactly.
There is. Yeah. I was going to go, no, I could knock that out
easily.
Are you
going to try the one that's six times hotter?
I certainly would try it, because I just like hot food.
The three chili foil has never disappointed anyone who's bought it, trust me. And I find it too hot. But the thing is, because these are all cooked in exactly the same way, there's nothing stopping you having a hot one, a medium one, and a mild one. Having a spoonful of it, because I can see you've obviously just a teaspoonful of that's enough. And then what you don't eat, you freeze it.
Oh, I couldn't eat that. No way. There's no chance in hell. I thought it was fine when I had it.
It does.
About five seconds later. Oh, God.
Andrew was very right about that. It is an after kick. You get it in your mouth and you think,
that's nothing.
And then all of a sudden it kicks in.
Yeah. Number of people I've seen just thinking, yeah, that's nothing. And then you leave it 5 minutes and then they think, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you need to realise with what Andrew's done is that essentially what you have to do is you buy these. They're powders, they're mixes of spices that he obviously grinds himself and everything. And then you have your own base of onion and garlic and ginger. So you do that, and then you make your own sauces up. Some of them require coconut milk, don't they? And others don't.
Yeah, I mean the way you cook it is that you make what's called the secret sauce. It's no secret. It's onion, garlic, ginger, and water. The secret is it's the base to everything. There's also we tell you how to make the Southeast Asian version, which has galangal as opposed to ginger, and shallots as opposed to onions. But essentially, it's the same. There are different ways of doing it, but the way we tell you how to do it on the card that you get in each packet tells you how to do it. Is the easiest way, the most consistent way. You add our spices to the secret sauce, then add a can of coconut milk or tomatoes, dependent on the recipe, and that's it. You're good to go. It's that straightforward.
And how nice are they, though, Paul? Because
they're gorgeous.
Feels like they're amazingly homemade, with huge amounts of care and attention. Actually, all you've done is chop up some onion and a bit of garlic, and that's about it.
I like the balance of that, because it's homemade without the hassle. I just wanted to ask, on the packets, on the spice packets, does it have the recipe on the packets?
Yeah, you get inside each of the packets, you get like a card which tells you how to do it. We're not into the business of just selling you the spices and then just go and figure it out yourself. We take you through it step by step, and it really is that simple, literally that simple.
And also, if you go on the website, Paul, they've got loads of recipes on there to do with it. But for me, mixing spices is actually incredibly skilled. You know, when do you put them in? What do you do? And somebody's done the balance for you. Because the problem with spices at home is some of them are older than others, some of them are stronger than others. You know, so even if it says put a teaspoon of this or whatever, it's actually hard to get it right. Whereas this has all been done for you.
So the other thing that people don't actually realise, it's not about with our spice mixtures as well. We actually, because I grow most of these chilies myself, and if I don't, I grow the fresh chilies. I buy fresh chilies, dry them and grind them. But different chilies have different flavours and different heat levels, obviously. So in each of these, there's a different chili in all of them. It's not. You know, it's not a case of like spooning more chilies into your mixture. It's a case of using the right chilies. And as I said, we don't use chili powder. It's just not. It's not done. It's not right. And it just doesn't. Well, you can tell if you taste this well as you have. You tell the difference. You know,
that's why it tastes so different.
Well, I love the product. I have them at home already. Are you a fan now?
I am, and I can understand your enthusiasm for it. They are absolutely gorgeous. They're delightful. They're fantastic tasting. And it makes the process so simple of making a really good quality homemade curry.
Yeah. And also, in case anybody wanted to know, they're vegan, gluten-free and dairy-free. So as long as you're adding the right ingredients, the spices themselves are for everybody.
There you go. Beef curry.
No. I meant the spices, yeah, well, not.
Well, the mind boggles on that one. But anyway,
it's really great to have you here. Thank you, Andrew. And if anybody's interested in ordering, they need to go onto bitspicy.com.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Well, there you go, Christy. They are really lovely curries, and what better than somebody doing all your spices for you? But you're still adding coconut milk, your favourite meats and favourite veg.
Yeah, still cooking from scratch, but just getting a bit of a helping hand with the spices, because there's so many, aren't there? So brilliant.
And a bit of a bombshell, he doesn't use chili.
Yeah,
doesn't use chili powder. Doesn't use chili powder. He just says it's not done.
What's the point?
It's not done.
Something like that. He said, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, because you can get the heat from so many spices, and it's not such then a sledgehammer hit, if you see what I mean. So
I thought
they
were.
I think they're lovely, and I buy them a lot. I really do think they're.
Oh, you're converted to them, are you?
Oh, I've had them for a while, and also the recipes they've got on their website are great. Really good to follow.
Oh, check it out.
Check it out. I'm going to talk eggs. Now, I am an egg fiend. I love eggs. I absolutely love eggs. So I generally, and Christy can she was with me for a breakfast meeting this morning, can attest to the fact that I did have two poached eggs.
You did indeed.
Avocado on toast, which is my favourite for breakfast.
And also very trendy.
I know, but I am trendy. So that fits in nicely. And the good thing about eggs is apparently they boost weight loss. So get them down.
Oh.
You. And did you know
pass
that?
Pass those eggs over.
Yeah,
here
they
now.
Contain vitamins B2, B12, A and E. Really good for you. Previously, I think it was that woman, Edwina Curry.
Egg Wiener.
Curry. She did all that advice, didn't she? Or one of them, one of those MP things, saying that eggs have high cholesterol levels or they've got salmonella and all that sort of thing, and you shouldn't eat them. And if you're pregnant, you know, something's going to happen. But also this high cholesterol level thing has now been disproved largely. Mm. I think some people still think that's
have
the case
it, yeah.
But actually not and some people say that actually reduces cholesterol levels in humans. Anyway, we do like our eggs because we eat 12.3 billion eggs, not million, billion eggs in the UK every year. That's 34 million each day, and I had two today, so
it contributed to that.
I did.
Well done.
And sales of eggs in 2005, so that's last year, reached nearly £900 million. One of the statistics I'm really pleased to see is that now just under half of all eggs sold are free range.
I'm really pleased to see that. I will not buy anything about that, would you?
No, and I think also it's to do with the flavour as well. So I'm really pleased to be joined by Matt Havers. He's got some eggs here, but he's gonna branch out and do different things. But first of all, we want to talk eggs. And Matt, you are involved in Kings Farm Foods.
You can almost say that I am.
You
King
am. Oh, I love that. You are.
Only because it's You couldn't even say that that's a brand yet, really. We're about to launch our first product at Food Matters Live. So
Food Matters Live. That's so tell me about chickens and eggs, because you're saying you have a... Do you call them a flock?
Yeah. So we, my family farms 16,000 free-range chickens on the family farm.
I think that's quite a lot.
In industry standards, it's not.
It's not. Okay.
No, but we only started sort of 6-7 years ago, and at that point, it was still a case of, well, do you put cage? Do you do barn? Do you do free-range? Do you do organic? And free-range for us was just... You know,
really important.
Yeah, because
do you mind explaining to me the difference? Because barn eggs, some people buy barn eggs thinking, oh, that's okay, it means that essentially it's free range, but that's not true at all, is it?
No. So off the back of a recent campaign done, it's primarily against Tesco's to try and ban caged eggs. The industry now is at a big turning point because there's always needed to be a value egg for people of lower income.
Yeah,
so
sure,
that has always
sure.
been caged. It's had a role. But now caged, all the retailers are moving away from it. The question is, what becomes the new bottom rung? Barn is seen as an option, but barn essentially is, yes, the chickens aren't in cages, but they're still in a big shed with no natural light, probably not too
packed
much.
In.
Yeah, well, it'd be more like broilers, which are chickens for meat production. So they wouldn't have the benefit of going outside. They would be probably... quite a bit denser in populations in the same size shed. But free range obviously has per bird has to have a set meterage of available pasture inside, outside, and the sort. So ours has 20 acres for the 16,000 birds.
And for me, when I go, I have to say I'm not bothered about organic. That doesn't really do it for me. But I am absolutely scrupulous about it being free range.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the packaging, it's a little bit deceptive in that it'll say barn egg, but you see a chicken wandering around in a wood on its own with 4 acres to itself.
Yeah, I mean...
You really do need to look at the packet, don't you? Because some of it's a little bit misleading.
Yeah, I think lots of brands have now looked at trying to see how they can differentiate within an egg, because a lot of people will think, well, there's free-range organic, you know, is that the only tier? But some people now, I mean, Marks and Spencers, for instance, are doing a woodland egg where, for instance, a set acreage has to be woodland for the chickens to go around, and then growers get a premium, basically. But it is misleading, and people are now beginning to think whether if free-range becomes the new bottom layer, is it worthwhile having a differentiating point of... How are they free range? For instance, there's two. This is probably getting boring for most people.
No.
But there's something called flat deck and multi tier. Flat deck is basically where there's not levels of perching for birds, and they're all on a single level and they go out through.
A bit like car parks.
Yeah.
So
well, multi. Yeah.
Multi-story.
Exactly.
And the
ones
just whiz around and try and find.
But in some ways it. If you go in a multi-tier shed, we have flat deck, but multi-tier, you look at it and it looks a lot more industrial. So it looks how people perceive the bad side of food. But if you go in it and understand a chicken mentality, a chicken will always look to perch at a higher point.
And roost,
So it's almost like a jungle gym for them because they've got bits they can go around, they've got new bits of food, they can...
Got swings.
Yeah, pretty much. So... But it's then again, it's perception again. Like there was a campaign down in the Southwest where they said no to multi-tier. So it's all up in the air at the moment. There's lots of different voices.
And again, I think the press, have a responsibility sometimes.
Yeah, they always
do. And actually
do,
what
they
do is they just take a very, very simplistic view of things. Whereas what we really need to do is if we can educate people more about food, I don't think we should then tell them what to do. I think if they're educated about it and understand the egg industry, then they can make their own choices.
Absolutely, as long as those choices are clear.
Because they know what that means, if you see what I mean. The other thing I see on packaging is, British eggs, as if British eggs means it's free range. And that's not true either, is it?
No, there's because we're not just chicken farmers. We have sort of pigs and a few other bits and pieces. And there's across the whole industry, there's little tricks you can see that are misleading.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, you can have free-range reared pork, for instance. And that means they've been reared outside, but yet as soon as they get to an age where they need to put on weight quicker, they'll go to an indoor unit. But
they've been outside for 5 minutes.
Exactly. With packaging, eggs probably as a product is simpler than others, but I would always say to look for the Lion Code when it comes to eggs because that ensures that there's been a lot of QC, a lot of love, a lot of care gone into the birds.
So there's a top tip there, listeners.
Yep. Look for the line.
Look out for the line. You've bought us a pack of eggs there, and there's 12 eggs.
Have.
Now, those eggs don't look like any of the eggs I've ever seen.
No,
they're different sizes, which is fine. They've got little speckly bits and all that sort of stuff. And then some of them have got some stuff on the outside. Well, what's that?
So
you'd never sell those to supermarkets, would you? You've got no chance.
No. So they've been brought in as an example. These are what we would class in the industry as a second grade egg. So...
And that's not to do with flavour?
No. Everything on the inside would be completely normal to a first grade. First grade is something where you will look in the supermarket, they'll be uniform, same kind of colour, and it's how supermarkets deem how a customer likes an egg. These ones are they're there because they don't look right. There's nothing wrong with them inside. It's just on the outside. So these are what would never make it to a supermarket.
See, they look okay. They look like eggs. I'm just describing them. You know, they don't look like some monster thing.
But you see, nobody... I mean, I was trying to find one to bring you, but a lot of the time you'll get a shell-less egg, which is bizarre. Yeah. So it'll be like putty in your hand, but it'll still have the membrane. So it'll be a whole egg, just no shell. Yeah. And you get so many bizarre ones. Like you'll get like torpedo eggs that are probably like 2 or 3 inches
shape.
Long. Yeah, exactly. and it's every chicken is different.
Yeah.
And a chicken on a given day, if it has a shock, a scare, a challenge, a fright, a fight with another chicken, it'll all determine, like, you can almost see, like, you know, on like a tree where you can see on dry years when you cut it, like it was narrow. It's like that with an egg. Like you can see sometimes a line around the egg where it's looked like it's got a belt on that's a bit too tight almost. And that will be where it's like a helicopter's gone over or something of the sorts, and it's frightened the bird and it will affect that egg.
So you can read the eggs.
Yeah, pretty much. You I am the egg line. Teller. Yeah.
You can tarot card reader, but with eggs.
Yeah.
You can read.
And for chickens.
You can read the life of the chicken.
Yeah.
I don't spend all my day doing
no?
this.
No, are you sure?
Give me your egg and I'll tell you where you've been, sonny boy.
No.
But that's really interesting, though. I didn't know.
So, but just explain that stuff that you got. You said to me that earlier that you were saying that some of the shell could be a little bit thin, you know, but that doesn't mean anything to the flavour.
No, so...
But there's also some... did you say calcification on some of those?
So a chicken's diet will very much determine how an egg comes out. So if a chicken has too much calcium in its diet, it will come out in the egg as like little bits of calcification or different speckles and things like that. But basically, each one of these eggs has a slightly different fault, which means it wouldn't make it to supermarket. You always allow a percentage for that in a flock, but sometimes you'll have a real challenge where it ends up ruining a lot of eggs. And this means that the farmer doesn't make any money off it. A lot of it ends up as food waste. And unless you can find something to do with them, then it's ends up being quite a large proportion of the industry. I mean, it's just waste. Yeah, you allow sort of a good flock would be 2-3%. So if you consider we get 16,000 eggs a day, you know, 1% is 160. So you're looking at 400 eggs a day just from our unit. That
being wasted, essentially.
Yeah, sometimes.
And when you consider that eggs are a superfood.
Completely.
You know, and they're so amazingly versatile. And you can cook fast food, obviously, with eggs.
Yeah.
That's terrible, isn't it? Because there's nothing wrong
really,
with them.
Really, really bad, yeah.
There's nothing wrong with them at all.
Mm. No. 400 is quite a lot to get through in one day on your own as well.
Yeah. Rocky Balboa would struggle with that.
So you've got a little bit of this food waste, and that got you thinking a bit, I think.
Yeah, so you kind of touched on it yourself as well, in that eggs are, well, they are probably the most robust superfood in nature because, an egg by nature is to support life. It's everything there to grow a life. So it's only right that nutrition can be used in our bodies every single way, basically. But it also is completely not versatile in some ways, in that you always need a pan and you always have to cook them in your home. Like there's no way to take them out and about.
I don't really like them raw.
No, I mean, if you're ever unlucky enough in an office to be sat next to someone who's brought some boiled eggs to work, it's pretty horrific if they just crack that open at lunchtime.
I'm guilty of that sometimes.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Shame on you.
I don't
you.
Sit next to you, thankfully.
No. But yeah, no, it basically led me to think that I, at the time, was playing a lot of rugby, having a lot of dairy-based nutrition to support muscle growth. And I couldn't understand why nobody had done anything with egg. And here I had a lot of eggs that weren't being used, something that I could try and innovate something with.
And so what you mean is you wanted to try and find a way of capturing that protein
to
help you in your sporting life.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's only so many eggs you can eat in your scrambled, your poached, they're great, but you can't have enough of them when you're eating them. And breaks, of course, like I bet you this more, you had them as breakfast, is that right?
I did have two poached eggs, on my avocado toast, yeah.
See, that's the biggest occasion for eating eggs is always at breakfast.
I don't know why we do that. Why do we do that?
I don't know. I think it's because I think it's like something that comes from 40, 50 years ago. It's like start a day on a healthy way with an egg kind of thing. But for people who don't have, industry's changing and people have less time to prepare food. So I tried to make a way of bringing the goodness of egg to something you can take with you in a bottle.
So you've essentially got an egg-based protein drink.
Yeah. So
and did you take the yolk or just the white bit?
Well, until I think mainstream consumers are ready to accept fat as something that's a necessity, and there's good and bad fats. We're getting there, but I don't think we're there yet. We didn't innovate the whole egg to begin with simply because of the fat content. That's going to be the second launch because, like you said, if you had a list of the vitamins and minerals in an egg yolk, you don't ever need to have a supplement in your life.
No.
Pretty much. But at the moment, it's just the egg white. So per bottle, there's 5 egg whites. If you imagine that as a breakfast, that's pretty hearty.
So you've got 3 different flavours.
Yes.
This is an egg-based healthy protein drink, egg whites-based.
Yeah.
You've got some soy milk in there and some real fruit. And there's strawberry and lime, mango and passion fruit, and raspberry and blueberry.
Yes.
You've obviously low in sugar, goes without saying. Don't have any artificial colours, flavourings, or preservatives.
Or sweeteners. I forgot to put that on the...
Sweeteners.
Yeah.
And you've created this product, and it hasn't even been launched yet.
No,
this is a first.
That's the exciting, terrifying bit. We're launching at Food Matters Live. So it's exciting, it's thrilling, it's nervous time as well, but we're confident that we're bringing something completely different to the market, and it fulfills a need for people who are dairy intolerant, because every protein drink in the market is dairy based, pretty much. And the ones that offer alternatives like pea protein or soy protein,
they don't taste like,
you have to eat an awful lot of peas in nature to get the level of protein that that these people need. And we've got 30 grams per bottle, which is up there with competitive.
Well, Christy and I are just about to taste the strawberry and lime. Or have you tasted it already? You've gone straight in there.
I've tasted all three at once.
Okay.
Not at once. Sorry,
you talk, I'm going to try strawberry.
Okay. They're really refreshing.
Yeah.
They're not as... I don't know why I thought this, but I thought they might be quite thick, like a smoothie consistency, but they're not at all.
One of the whole concepts is when we said we were making a protein drink, people immediately associate with bodybuilders, hardcore gym people, and the disgusting kind of flavours that you usually have. For me, like chocolate, strawberries, vanillas, it didn't make sense, because people who are dieting and having protein drinks, like to have sweet, indulgent flavours that aren't necessarily sweet because they just chuck sucralose in, it seemed opposites.
Weird,
yeah, it seemed
it?
Weird.
It's not the point, is it? It's just not the
point. Exactly. If you're going to have something that tastes good, you're going to do it to be indulgent. You're not going to have something that's healthy for you and like just try and be something it's not. So the whole concept of PEC drinks is basically to make protein accessible to more people. And by doing so, we needed to completely scrap the rule book for protein drinks, like different flavours, different size, different marketing messages, and just a clean, healthy, natural protein, really.
It's really interesting because I've just tasted all three while Christy was chatting. And the flavours are lovely. The texture's quite interesting to me. And Tom, you've just had some as well. I don't know whether you've picked this up. He's just shoved a load of greens in his mouth, actually.
That boy loves his greens.
He loves his greens. He's got lovely skin. as I'm sure you can imagine. If you could see the studio, it looks disgusting.
Do you know what? I've taken a picture and put it on Twitter.
Look on Twitter. It is full of...
It's random, isn't it?
The zombie apocalypse comes right now. We'll be fine.
Salads. Salads, this fruit.
That's what I was saying about the texture as well, though. see, because it is quite thirst quenching, isn't it? It's not as thick or anything like
but
that.
But there is something about that sort of bitumen, slightly texture.
There's no bitumen in there.
not bitumen.
Just
what do you call it?
Yeah, just to go completely bitumen free.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the sort of, you get that slightly, I don't know how to explain it, slightly runny texture.
I think
from an egg. But it's really nice. So it gives it a bit of thickness, but not like a big huge smoothie where it's just far too much.
Yeah.
So you've got a natural thickness as opposed to a contrived.
It's not like water.
Thickness.
It's not that.
That's really nice. Like slightly sticky. That's what I mean.
Exactly what you mean. Is it like almost feels like a slight film on your lip, like a tiny
bit.
Yeah, that's the challenge we've had with using egg white.
It's really nice.
Because
though,
if you think when you crack an egg, it's just gloop. Isn't it? It's gloop that is not appetizing in the slightest. So what happens is, if you heat treat it, just you can't go above 61 degrees.
It'll scramble.
Yeah. So you have to be very careful about, and of course it's used as like a whisking and binding agent as well, because if you completely homogenize it to the nth degree, you just end up with foam. So
it's really difficult to get right.
Yeah,
then.
It is, exactly. So it's a very delicate balance of trying to keep the physical characteristics of egg away, but also keep all the positive things intact. So it's been a challenge.
I think you've cracked that, because it does.
Cracked it.
Great pun.
Do you know what?
There's a lot of egg puns out there.
I'd love to say that I actually thought of that, but I didn't. I do think you've cracked it.
Thank you.
Because it does feel like a natural product, and it sort of feels like it comes from eggs, but not in a bad way in the slightest. And protein, of course, egg protein is, of course, the best that you can do, really. And it's
natural.
Not contrived.
It's not taking it out of a big tub of powder and chucking it in some full fat milk, or I don't know how you make it.
I mean, it's not got, it's the absence of the powdery, which is unusual.
Yeah,
I think it's delicious.
Do you? Oh, great. You were quite quiet, so I was a bit nervous.
No, I really like it. Yeah,
that's
because
chomping on those pea shoots again.
That's true. This mango and passion fruit is my favourite, but yeah.
Mm. Yeah, which one's your favourite?
I like the blueberry.
There's more one for anyone who wants some.
Yeah, I think we might have some more.
And I think I like the strawberry one, so we've got like a real mix of it.
So rather scarily, you're going to launch the Peck drinks at Food Matters Live show. Christy, do you know when Food Matters Live's on? Because we're doing a radio show from there, aren't we?
We are indeed, so I should know when it is. Yeah. So it's 22nd of November, which is a Tuesday, right through until Thursday at Excel in London. And there are over 600 exhibitors, 400 speakers. And I think the theme around it is really between food, the relationship between food, health and nutrition. Mm. So the perfect place to be launching such a...
And I went there last year, and it's if anybody's interested in food and nutrition, not necessarily to buy products, but just to listen to some amazing speakers, it's really, really informative there's a great program, you know, across the 3 days. So I do think you've chosen a good one, a scary one.
Yeah.
A good one to launch.
Yeah, it's. I was shocked actually to see, I've never been there before, so you've got the edge on me there. But
it's huge.
When I saw, PhD students, like dietitians, nutritionists, people with NHS, you know, it's a real mixed bag
it's
of
really
people that go. It made me proper excited, because it's a conversation that I want to have with people. Mm. And we're the only people in the UK doing this. Actually, if you include the soy bit, we're the only people in the world that's done it. Mm. So it's to
get great feedback.
Yeah, to get feedback from the industry like that is that's the only event that is needed for it, really.
So how do you prepare for an exhibition like that? How many? I presume you've got loads and loads of samples. You've got your packaging, which is in front of us, which is really nice packaging, and you've set your pricing and so what how do you turn up and do those things?
Well, it's been a massive learning curve for me because my past position was in like FMCG and insights and intelligence. So it wasn't from the actual food industry.
FMCG being very fast moving goods that should
turnover
fast.
I used to work with people like Kellogg's, ingredients companies, DSM, people like that, to like look at what trend they need to be developing to hit a certain consumer demographic. So to actually be on the raw end of that and making stuff myself was terrifying. But it's just been a case of trying to see exactly what messages you want to take across, what kind of conversations you need to be having, what kind of people, ensuring that everything you have got to date looks credible to, if you have a buyer come up to
you, be really prepared and have everything ready, haven't you?
Like, it's the problem is that I'm very much on the here's a great idea and let's go through with it. Not so much the systematic, let's make sure we've got everything covered. I'm maybe more of a dreamer. So when it comes to the actual gritty truth of what you need to know and by when, that's the scary part, and that's the bit that's really taken hard work.
Yeah, Tom, have you got any advice? Because obviously you're a bit further down the line than Matt.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a dreamer as well. I have a really good business partner who's good at that stuff.
So let me get this right then: the boys do all the dreaming, take all the glory, and the women behind doing all the hard work, making sure it's happening. Or is that a generalisation?
I don't think they're going to say agree that, to that, are you?
No, but you can see their faces. Look at them smiling away there. but do you have any advice at all, Tom?
You know, I think it's you've just got to keep kind of pushing on with it. I think one of the things that we learned, like very early doors, is that no one believes in your products as much as you do, and you just got to get used to that and keep selling the message over and over again. But I think you've got a really solid product and very timely as well. Certainly, you know, you go into a gym, you look in the vending machines there, or every product's the same thing. It's a variation on a whey-based protein, and I think this is quite interesting. Certainly, I mean, I'm not a cow person. I don't eat cow products. So for me, it's a very interesting product. Yeah,
that's really good. I'm not a vegetarian. You know, that's not the description. I'm not a cow person. Yeah. So next time.
It is niche, right?
Yeah. Better description, isn't it?
There is actually a question that I think your business would be perfect to answer. Because how much on an exhibition show, if you're a young brand, you're just starting out, but you've got a dream of where you want to be, how much of your conversation with key people should be about where you are now and what your product has to offer versus if we had your support, sales support, this is what we could be? How much do you talk about the present? How much do you talk about the future?
I think it's difficult. I think the products are slightly different in that yours is ours is fresh produce, yours isn't. But at the same time, there's definitely an element there of it's got to be about where you're going. But at the same time, not overselling it and being realistic about what you can promise.
It's all about the taste. I mean, that's what will drive it. And I think price points are obviously quite important for some of these buyers. Mm. Really like the product. Beginning to run out of time. Sorry about that. But I think it's great. Did you like that?
I really liked it. Mm. I'm really surprised at the consistency of it. And I think you've done well to make it nice thirst-quenching drink that appeals to people that aren't just gym bunnies.
So we've got the Peck Natural Goodness from Matt Havers, and Peck is going to be launched at Food Matters Live, so go along to that if you're around. It's really worth going to. If you want to find out more about Matt, you need to go on to peoplewhopeck.com. quite like that, peoplewhopeck.com, and we'll be really interested to track how you're doing. Really interested to see if you can get some good buyers and get it mainstream.
We'll see you at the show, and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us on the show.
It's a pleasure. And then of course we were talking to Tom Webster, Grow Up. I'm not telling you to do that, Tom.
Tom the muncher.
Yeah, Tom the... He's continually
munching. There's a terrible reputation when people give me about eating all the time. I just don't think it's that
true. So it's growup.org.uk, which is all about his Grow Up Urban Farms, which is obviously a great concept. And in the middle, we were talking to Andrew Anderson, one of my favourite products, which is about... it's all about those lovely curries that you're making at home. It's going to inspire me to make a curry at the weekend, actually. I don't know about you, Christy.
Yeah. Don't see why not.
Yeah, you're going to cook your husband a chicken curry or something?
Yeah, a nice Madras maybe.
Nice bit of Madras. Mm. Okay. Well, that's the Food Talk show again for this week. Just to let you know, we've got loads of listeners at the moment in California and Michigan. So if you're listening in, hello to all our lovely American friends, as well as across the UK.
And they're probably missing Paul, but he's back next week.
Is he back next week?
Yeah.
So does that mean we're back to unhealthy kebabs?
Kebab chat, chili chat.
Yeah, chili chat and all that sort of stuff. Well, we've had a good time. The studio is a complete and utter mess. We'll try and clear it up.
I'll do it.
You'll do it. And I'm going to steal some of those pea shoots to take home for me for my dinner tonight. So thanks again to Tom and Matt. And goodbye to next week.